This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise. With the Grateful Dead saying fare thee well for the last time this weekend, we thought it would be appropriate to revisit my 2011 conversation with Grateful Dead drummer Bill Kreutzmann.
If I can help this beautiful world of ours, this blue-green gem floating in space, flying in space, really, any way I can to help it be a better place, then that's what I want to do today.
Today on Sea Change Radio, we have the honor of visiting with Bill Kreutzmann, former drummer of the Grateful Dead and organic gardener. We talk about the natural resources on the idyllic island of Kauai, where he currently lives and where he has developed a passion for these lush surroundings. We also learn how his hope for a healthier island and planet prompted his civil disobedience to prevent the Hawaii Super Ferry from docking in Nivilivili Harbor. As a lifelong fan of the band, I couldn't help but also ask him about his years with the Grateful Dead. He indulges me and recalls playing with Mickey, Phil, Bobby, and Jerry, talks about his most recent musical project, and about how, in the post-Jerry Garcia era, the band's remaining members feel a little more free to become advocates for causes that most inspire them. My guest today on Sea Change Radio is the former drummer of the Grateful Dead, a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. His new project is Seven Walkers. He lives in Kauai. Bill Kreutzmann. Bill, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
How you doing, Alex? It's nice to be on the show.
Great to have you here. When we last spoke, you mentioned that you had made a promise to your longtime musical collaborator and friend, Jerry Garcia, to move to Hawaii someday. Tell us how you fell in love with the Hawaiian Islands together.
Well, Jerry and I always had an interest in diving, and we started getting certified when we were making a record in Marin County. There was a dive shop across from where we were recording, and we went over there and started taking lessons, pool lessons, like the first part of your training. And then we knew people over here, and this is actually Jack's Dive Locker. I'd like to give him a plug. They're great folks. On Big Island in Kona. And him and I would go there diving all the time. And one day we were standing on the back of this dive boat and just me and him talking. And we shook hands and said, okay, when the Grateful Dead ends, we're both going to move over here. And that's how that all started. It was just from a love of the ocean. It was the same reason I'm so into the ocean today is it started then. It started from diving and seeing what it was like.
But even though Hawaii is an incredibly beautiful place, it's had its share of environmental issues to grapple with. You have all of these natural resources, but import about 90% of your energy needs. How do you see things changing in Hawaii breaking out of this cycle?
One way to change the problem of burning fossil fuels is to provide non-fossil fuels, to build solar fuels. All this kind of thing is going to decrease the need for fossil fuels of any sort. I know for a fact that there is no such thing as clean coal. It's an oxymoron, if anything. I know that nuclear power has such horrible waste requirements and what just happened in Japan. And there's approximately, I think, about 20 more of those reactors in the United States right now, the GE monsters. And like, I really believe Hawaii is leading in the solar field as far as islands are concerned, for sure. We have to keep doing that more.
People think of Hawaii as this island paradise, but look for a moment at some of the recent problems. There in Kauai, for example, you had a high-speed super ferry that was proposed to run from Oahu, which stirred up quite a bit of controversy.
Yeah, that was one of the proudest moments I've ever had, is that I was actually part of that. I was out in a kayak hanging out with all the surfers and people on different, whatever floated just about, you know. Some people were in the water just floating around. And we physically stopped it. It couldn't come into Nawiliwili Harbor. And the reason you want to stop that is the thing can carry up to 200 cars and carry 500, 600 people. And to just suddenly put that debilitating amount of people and cars onto a very small island, which is already crowded because our biggest roads here mostly are two-lane roads, is horrible for this island. And then everybody knew that. And all the resources get used up immensely. People would come here from the other islands and, you know, stay for a few days, use all our fishing spots, and it would be overused in the worst way. As soon as I found out, they announced it on our great, we have a community radio station here, KKCR, and it's just the most wonderful station. It appeals to everybody, from locals, visitors, everybody on the island. And they announced it, and I heard the announcement, and I was racing to get in my pickup truck, threw my kayak and paddle in the back, and boom, I was out there. And everybody else heard the announcement. So there were quite a bunch of us. There was a strange addition to that. These guys are so serious that we caught the people up on the flybridge on the thing, chumming, throwing raw food and stuff in the water to attract sharks while we were out in the water. I mean, it was like, are you kidding me? You know, it would be like moving a giant building into a very small area and having that area not be affected by it. That's impossible. The sad fact, Alex, is they're going after it again. It seems like this thing, this greed, this monster, big money, never rests.
I mean, Hawaii is known for its pristine waters, but I remember when I was in Oahu a few years ago, there were several beach closings because of the raw sewage coming from the Alawai Canal. So clean water isn't something to take for granted. It takes vigilance and hard work from activists to keep it that way.
I agree. I mean, I can't imagine. It's not just on the islands that they pump raw sewage out into the ocean. It happens on the coast of California and different places. And that always bothered the heck out of me. It doesn't work with the ocean environment. It doesn't work with the phytoplankton, the most small critters out there in the ocean. There's another thing about the ocean. I'm glad you brought this up. And that is this thing called the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. Have you ever heard of that?
We did a piece on that last year, actually, and interviewed the founder of Project Kaisei, Doug Woodring. People can check that out in our archives at seachangeradio.com.
That's very good. I'm glad I didn't see that one in your list there when I looked at them the other day. What are we dealing with here? We're dealing with there's too many people on this beautiful planet Earth, you know? And that's the saddest fact. Now that we have that, if we could be smart enough not to increase that and try to make it work the way it is without adding more, saying, okay, we're going to be fine if we add another 2 billion people, which is crazy. But this whole thing right now we're talking about is really that there's too many people. And it's going to take some heavy-duty decision-making and some people with some really good policies, politicians, of course, with good policies, if there is such a thing, and I know there is or are. I support all life on this planet. Not just the human life, you know. I think that all life on this planet should have an equal, fair chance of living.
And not just animals either. You're not too far from Hanalei Bay, are you?
No, 9 miles.
I know that there have been erosion problems there that are killing the reefs, the coral reefs near Hanalei Bay. Can you tell our listeners a bit more about this issue?
Exactly right. There's been erosion from natural occurring heavy rains. We have monsoons here once or twice a year, and it rains so hard you can't drive. You have to really pull over. You'd be silly if you tried to drive. And that'll naturally wash topsoil and dirt down. But the bigger problem is development. People will build a house somewhere, and they'll grade it, and they'll get permits to do this work, or a little shopping mall. And that becomes all loose soil that gets washed down into the ocean. The other real problem, too, Alex, are golf courses. I'm proud to say I've never played a golf game in my life, you know, but there's so many of them that when I used to fish, I don't fish anymore, but when I used to, when I first came here 20 years ago, you come across these giant green patches out in the ocean, almost like a psychedelic green, this bright day-glow green, and you wonder, what caused that? And I found out, I talked to a friend, a naturalist, and they said, oh, that's the runoff from the golf courses causing algae bloom. Can't we use something more organic that might not feed the ocean quite so badly?
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu. This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. Now back to my discussion with Grateful Dead drummer Bill Kreutzmann. Obviously, a large part of the Hawaiian economy, all the islands, is tourism and vacation homes, but that has an environmental impact as well, doesn't it, Bill?
It really does. And the first thing that comes to mind is that when people come over and they build a house, they buy a house, maybe it's already built, they're here for 2 weeks, so they don't really plug in to helping the neighborhood. They don't really plug in to what the island needs. They come here for their 2 weeks or whatever the length of time is, and they have a great time, and I'm glad they get to do that. But it doesn't really help the island. Financially, it does, but it doesn't help the island at the roots level, at the most basic level, and that would be to grow, you know, to really open up an agricultural base here, which we don't have yet. We have so much land that could be put back into agricultural use. In the old days, when the Hawaiians were here, 2,000 years ago or more even, this whole place was just thriving agricultural land, all the way up and down the coast here on Kauai, all around the island. It was a giant garden, and it was totally sustainable because it had to be. They didn't import anything, and they lived quite well. And then the English came along. They saw how well the Hawaiians gardened. They took many plants back to England and things like that. But they also made other changes and this is what we're holding on to today. And it's not, I have nothing against the tourism business in itself. I just wish that any monies that were gained from that would be put more into environmental practices, not just trying to enlarge the tourism business by putting in a super ferry. The super ferry could carry, I think, up to 200 cars, and each time it would dock here, it was allowed to do it once or twice, I believe, it unloaded hundreds of cars onto an island that's already terribly burdened by traffic.
People don't think of Hawaii as having traffic, but it does.
You live here, and you'd never say that.
let's dive into life on the road a little bit with the Grateful Dead. I was thinking of the Wall of Sound, which was almost 40 years ago, where you decided to create one of the largest PA systems the world has ever seen, and that was chronicled pretty well in the Grateful Dead movie. In, I think 1974, 75, or no, I think it came out later because it took so long to produce. But that obviously was something that wouldn't be happening today, probably, when you consider sustainability and gas prices. But then I was thinking about it. That was right during the height of the gas crunch. What were some of the finances that went into that calculus?
Well, it was during that 73 gas crunch, that's for sure. But that didn't play a great problem for us. We didn't drive all that much. The Wall of Sound was so tremendous, it was unwieldy at best. We had a lot of rather angry crew guys having to set that thing up at each concert, and it was a great acoustic experiment, but it didn't resolve at the end. It didn't pay for itself in that way, in the sound way. So we never overdid that, so we didn't actually have to drive it that much. But the thing that comes to mind is a concert I just played recently on Earth Day at Topanga Canyon. The whole show, everything, all the electricity requirements were all done by solar.
This is with Seven Walkers?
This is with Seven Walkers. That's a new band I'm playing in now.
Why don't you tell our listeners who's in that band?
Well, obviously myself and then Papa Molly, Malcolm Wellborn. He's the lead guitar player and lead vocalist. Then Matt Hubbard is a multi-instrumental guy. He plays the keyboards, trombone, harmonica, and sings. And then also original Meters bass player, George Porter Jr., is my bass player.
Yeah, I had a friend tell me it's like hearing the Meters play the Grateful Dead sometimes, which I find pretty intriguing since those are two of my favorite bands.
That's a great compliment for me. And what you just said is really interesting because Deadheads have always liked New Orleans music. Meters, Neville Brothers, Radiators, Galactic, you know, and they've always, you know, and been Deadheads, so they like the Dead. And now we're getting a combination of that, a real solid combination. When you have the bass player from the Meters and the original drummer from the Grateful Dead, that makes We jokingly, we call it Swampadelic.
I like that. Swampadelic.
And it is. And matter of fact, George Porter Jr. sings Sugar Ree, and oh my God, it's so soulful. It just brings tears to my eyes of joy every time we get to play that song.
So there's a scene which I just love in the Grateful Dead movie where you say, quote, "I call myself a four-sided schizophrenic because you have to have four separate ideas going and then a single thing here. It's more than just patting your head and rubbing your stomach because you're doing it with four things." When you get that down in music and drumming in particular, then you get so you can be dancing. And that is really fine because you sit back there and it feels just like you're dancing. You're playing and the groove is just right and the kicks aren't made. The accents and the rolls, they're not made. They're just into the flow. And that's the kind of music I like. So hearing you talk about dancing and drumming like dancing, what's in your life in Hawaii that most closely replicates that feeling?
This may surprise you, but it's gardening. I mean, I jam over here with wonderful musicians, but when I go out and I garden, I actually start moving around the garden like that. We have an organic garden here, of course, and it gives me such pleasure to be working with the earth and being able to do something right with the earth and be able to have the earth, it talks to me. And you ask any gardener out there, they'll say, yeah, the plants talk to you, you know, and it really does. And this is the thing it says. The earth says, thank you for doing the right thing with me. Instead of blowing the top off me to get coal or destroying me by digging these thousand, you know, mile deep holes in the ocean and the ocean floor to get oil, you're planting something that's giving back to me, and then I can feed you. So that's my new line to the four-sided schizophrenic. That line, by the way, was before I really understood what schizophrenic meant. But it just means that you do four separate things when you're playing drums. Like I'd have my right hand would be playing with the lead, would be playing with Jerry. My foot would be playing with whatever Phil was playing. The backbeat would be me, and then the other hand and stuff would, or foot would be with Bobby. So I'd roll it around like that. That's what I meant by that four-sided schizophrenia. I always kind of regretted saying that a little bit, even though it sounds good when you read it.
I can just look in awe at somebody who can do four things. I have enough trouble just getting both my hands to move on piano or guitar. And so many musicians really have grown up injecting themselves into the Grateful Dead's music. I know when I was a teenager, I'd play along with Dead tapes and I'd figure out a tune or try to fit my guitar sound into a jam. And think, hey, you know, I could be doing this. And it definitely inspired generations of people to go out and play. When you play along with recorded music, I assume you still do it to keep your chops up. What other bands could you see yourself playing in?
Yeah, the Grateful Dead was so all-consuming, you'd never even consider taking 6 months away from it. But the other bands I wanted to play with, I did play with them. I just didn't get to play with them physically. I did like you suggested, I would put on earphones. That's actually how I do warm up today, is I sit in my little studio here. And one of my favorite bands right now to play to, let's get it more current, is Dumpster Funk, which is a New Orleans band. You know, they play some real hard groove stuff, some deep groove stuff with really cool accents and syncopations. And I love following along, making myself learn that stuff, you know. Not that I'll ever use it exactly like that. It's just the idea of being able to play it, then you have it within you. And then you can modify it, and you do. You change what you're hearing into something that has the same feeling, but maybe is done differently. This last record I made with Seven Walkers, Papa was listening back to the roughs of the song Seven Walkers, and he said, Bill, they're going to think you're from New Orleans, but you play it differently, but it still sounds like you're from New Orleans. And that was my goal, is my goal, is that instead of copying an exact part, copy the way it flavors, copy the way it feels, and do it that way instead of playing note for note.
Yeah, but I can imagine playing as a drummer, the real thing you're always listening to is the bass, and evolving musically with Phil Lesh as your bassist, comparing it to somebody like in the Dumpster Funk's bassist. I forget who it is. Is it Tony Hall or one of the Neville former Neville brother bassists?
There's two. There's Tony, and I'm sorry, I missed the other guy's
name. They're both monsters, but they're totally in the pocket kind of players. It must expand your musical horizons to be able to take a taste of this and a taste of that while your roots are Phil Lesh.
Well, my first musical roots are definitely like you're saying, but before the Grateful Dead started, when I was in even junior high school, I was playing with guys that were 20 years old because I was the young go-for-it drummer, right? I didn't know any better. My dad would drive me in the station wagon to gigs at YMCA, or I'd play at the Stanford University fraternity parties and stuff like that. I couldn't work enough. And so that, as a kid, I was like that. But then once the Grateful Dead started, you couldn't leave it. It was just all there, you know. And I was always just a little frustrated, and this is on me, that I played only in the Grateful Dead during that time period, those 30 years of Grateful Dead music. I had some other side bands, but nothing like I'm doing now. See, I didn't study in the formal sense. I didn't go to college to study music. I studied by, just like you suggested, I would listen to music and make my stuff sound like that, and until it did sound like that. And that's part of patting your head and rubbing your stomach. That thing is that I would come across something I really liked, a musical idea, whatever band it was, and I'd make myself learn that part so it was so natural I didn't have to think about it anymore. When I finally got it so natural that I wasn't having to put a mental process to it to make it work, it was just a feeling working, I would memorize that feeling. And that way I could learn the part the best. Instead of just having it superficially memorized, I would learn it down inside more.
And you juxtapose that with your musical brother, Mickey Hart, who came from a more traditional marching band tradition, correct?
Yeah, which I never understood. I used to always kid him about this. I say, come on, play that bass drum a little more, you know? And he said, well, I've been marching for all these years, and we only use our two hands.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. Now back to my discussion with Grateful Dead drummer Bill Kreutzmann. Deadheads have a warm spot in their hearts for certain dates and places. And like, if I go up to a Deadhead and I find out that he likes the Dead, I can mention Barton Hall 5877. I can say Fillmore East 42871, 21370. These are like the famous shows, and I assume that they all kind of meld together in your brain because you actually lived it and played it. But do you ever catch yourself in your garden sitting back and remembering a few of these dates and say, hey, I remember that 213, when that would have been 40 years ago since we played Alligator there or Darkstar?
I don't have that analytical type of memory, and the way I really remember shows is I remember the feeling from them, that they really felt good, or, you know, a lot of cool people came and the band played great. And I just have that good feeling when I'm out in the garden. I'm not really thinking about music particularly. I don't know, maybe I just walk naturally in rhythm.
How do these memories get thrown back into your brain after living them so many years ago?
They're not literal memories. They're not like a reporter going to the gig and saying, okay, this happened, and that happened, right? The memories for me do run together, like you suggested, and it's more of a feeling that I get. I say, God, that gig was really cool. I feel good. That's what I remember. I don't remember any specifics about Jill meeting Jeff or this person meeting that person or somebody having a baby, you know.
Is this what you're talking about a little bit? You get these little feelings that like replicate what you felt in an era?
It's like, if I think back, this is a real straight heart example. I think back to the show Altamont. We didn't actually play, but we were standing on the stage when that horrible stuff happened. I get a bad taste almost. Like, oh, I don't want to talk about that. I don't want to tell you or anybody about the specifics of what I saw that day. I just put that in, oh, too bad that ever had to happen, you know?
Right.
The good shows are quite the opposite. You just have a good feeling in your heart, in your gut. That, oh, that was really fun. A lot of people had a great time, and you felt really good doing it. And that's how I remember shows. I remember Woodstock because we were getting slightly electrocuted by the scaffolding. It wasn't properly grounded. I remember Watkins Glen when we played to 600,000 people and flying in.
But the sound check of Watkins Glen is what people remember from that.
You're right. The sound check. Me and Jerry both agreed that we played better at the sound check than we did the gig, you know. But when we flew in the day of the gig, Every place you looked was a person. I've never seen anything like that.
Can you differentiate your memories from when you were playing as a duo with Mickey on drums versus when you were back there solo, or is that kind of all meshed together?
No, actually, I remember more about playing with Mickey than I do when I was playing solo, to tell you the truth. He was influential to me. It was very important to me because he came in, like you said earlier, with rudiments, drumming rudiments, and he said, this would be really cool. You could play the drums, but if you learn this stuff, it'll really add on. You could compare it to going to graduate school. And he taught me the rudiments, and we practiced and all that. And it became part of my personality, and I started using these in my playing, and it helped immensely. And him and I have had some of the most amazing drum sessions and drums in space in the Grateful Dead than I can ever recall. They're so amazing that I think you'd have to be somebody like Einstein to remember them.
Well, we have some of them in our hearts as Deadheads. I think everyone has their own little favorites. And having that archive and having all the tapes there, you really, you were like the first open source business model in a lot of ways, which we're seeing now playing itself out on the internet. It allowed people to have their own experiences with it instead of, it didn't have to just be what you projected.
That's exactly right. That's why we played music that you could have many feelings or many opinions about. You know, it wasn't clear cut, oh, this is good or bad. It's just for me too, and the rest of the guys in the Dead. The bouquet of flowers is more interesting than one flower.
We had John Perry Barlow on the show last year, and he was saying how one of the things that he and Hunter wanted to be quite sure about doing was to be as, they didn't want to be too concrete in the words intentionally, because there was already kind of this dogma about the Deadheads that was bordering on a religion, which they found to be a little troubling. So they wanted to keep it alluring enough, but not didactic, and not, I guess that goes hand in hand with Grateful Dead not making any pure political stands back in when the band was up and running.
Well, all we knew to back was freedom. We didn't know any politicians then. And if Garcia was still alive, which I wish he was, he would not have gone for us supporting any politician, even Obama. He would have fought hand and foot not to. He wouldn't have done it. That's all I can tell you.
So he was the biggest naysayer in the band from taking political stands?
Yeah, 100%. He was a teacher there.
So it's good to see that despite Jerry Garcia's his own internal struggle that he had with wanting to use your music for greater issues, I'm glad to see that people like you and Bob and the rest of the band, I know, and Phil, whenever he plays, he always makes a little speech about organ donations. And I don't think that would have happened in 1980, but I think it's important to use your platform as effectively as you can. And you're not preaching.
If I can help this beautiful world of ours, this blue-green gem floating in space, flying in space, really, any way I can, to help it be a better place, then that's what I want to do today.
Bill Kreutzmann, you've brought a lot of joy to a lot of people with your music through the years, and it's been a delight having you on the show. Thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. Thanks. It's been a pleasure talking with you, my friend.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.